Hello, welcome to the Jazz Room. I'm your host, Joan Watson Jones. Thanks for stopping by. Come in, relax while we enjoy great jazz. Each week we present the music of independent jazz artists, as well as those we've grown to love through the years. And yes, of course, the legends. We open with the Clark Terry Quintet playing Donna Lee from the CD, Serenade to a Bus Seat. Our feature today is jazz icon Clark Terry. In 1996, we had the opportunity to meet and interview Clark at the University of New Hampshire. This was for the cable TV program Jones Jazz Jam. You'll hear that interview and sit in on an improvisation workshop Clark conducted for instrumental students at the college. Also, we'll talk with Professor Emeritus Paul Verrett of UNH, who was part of the program that regularly brought Clark to UNH. And he'll talk about when the college presented Clark with an honorary doctorate from UNH. Right now, enjoy the Clark Terry Quintet, Donna Lee. Creative Arts Center at the University of New Hampshire. And I'm sitting here talking with Clark Terry, renowned trumpeter, flugelhorn player, whose credits include the Duke Ellington Band and Count Basie Band. Hi, Clark. Welcome to Jones Jazz Jam.
Thank you. I'm very happy to be here. I mentioned earlier that it's a good thing we're not in Sweden, because if we were, I'd have to refer to your program as Jones Jazz Jam.
All right. That's what they'd have to do. Oh, that's great. That's great. Well, Clark, I know you come up here to UNH a lot.
Yes, I do.
Tell us about your connection with the University of New Hampshire, how it got started and so on.
Well, several years ago, in the 70s, late 70s, somebody had the graciousness and the kindness to offer me an honorary doctorate here in Humane Letters, and I came up, received it. I think it was 1978. Dave would know the exact year. I'm not sure. I'm very bad at keeping up with dates. Anyhow, ever since then, I've been sort of an Well, an adjunct professor and I come here several times a year for a week or two, and then they named this festival, which we're having this weekend, in honor of me several years ago. And we've had all sorts of things associated with the university, scholarship funds, and all sorts of things. And it's just been a beautiful relationship with me and the faculty and the departments of music here and the students. And I've enjoyed it very, very much, and I look forward to enjoying it many more years to come.
Well, it's just so great to have someone of your stature just come to New Hampshire and bring some of the wonderful jazz music to New Hampshire. Now, you're going to be doing some workshops today, aren't you?
Yes.
Okay, what's the workshop you're doing today?
Well, today is basically non-music students who find this class rather, rather interesting because it's sort of an insight like yours, you know, to enlightening people as to what jazz is about and with whom it's associated and what it goes back to and what it's leading up to and what are the expectations from the standpoint of the listeners who've never been involved in listening to jazz or being associated with jazz before. So it's a multifaceted thing, and I think it's very good for people who are not going to make their living in jazz to be jazz people, because the people who are going to pay for it, or the perpetuation of jazz, is people who like to listen to it. You know, we can't support ourselves.
That's right. We need the audience. Oh, well, as I said earlier in the program, I'd like you to just give us a little bit on your memories of working with the Duke Ellington Orchestra.
Well, I was very fortunate to have been a member of the Ellington Band, and consider myself very fortunate to have been what I consider a friend of Ellington. Was a friend of mine. I think he considered me as a friend, and we had a lot of beautiful moments on that band. I usually refer to my stint with the Ellington Band as the period during which I attended the University of Ellingtonia.
Yeah.
and it was pretty much like that too, Joan. You know, just being around this man, just through the process of osmosis, so many beautiful things would just rub off on you that you would use and would need to use further down your career when you're almost at a standstill as to what to choose and what selection to make and where to go. And you just reach back in the old computer and say, now what would Maestro have done? Oh, yeah, he would have done this.
Ken, I know that Ellington always had his lead musicians play, you know, do their arrangements and, you know, do their tunes. What are some, you know, can you just sort of give us some of your tunes, tell us names and so on of some of your stuff you did with him?
Well, I was fortunate enough to have several tunes in Ellington's band. See, as far as the makeup of publishing, et cetera, is concerned in jazz music, you can only be an ASCAP writer or a BMI writer. And I was, the ASCAP writer was usually for longevity if you got involved in writing a lot of things that are going to be well known. But then the BMI, people like myself, we would grab on to what we could grab on to in a hurry.
Yeah.
So Ellington was an ASCAP writer and I'm a BMI writer. And as a result, when we would do things with the Ellington band, I'd write things for that. He would have to, of course, put it in his outfit, so he would use my wife's name.
Oh.
And she was an ASCAP writer, you see.
Oh, I see.
Not really, but in order to be able to publish this music, me being a BMI writer, I couldn't say this is connected with Ellington because he was ASCAP, so it had to be somebody who was not BMI, so my wife was neither, so he just conveniently made her an ASCAP writer.
Oh, all right. Okay, well, yes, and, you know, I was listening, when we were at the Jazz Cons convention, I was listening to you and Frank Foster talk a little bit about you, talk about somewhere, working on Count Basie's band and Duke Ellington's band. How did that work?
That was beautiful, Basie, my association with Basie was also a very beautiful one. I am very proud to have been a part of both these bands and have known these two men very well, and was considered to be a friend to both of them. And I usually refer to my stint with the Basie Band as the period during which I attended the prep school for preparation for enrollment at the University of Ellingtonia.
Oh, my God.
So that's not too bad an education.
That's not too bad an education at all.
I have something very funny to tell you, though, Joan.
Okay.
I the University of New Hampshire was the first university to offer me an honorary doctorate back in 78, I think it was. Mm-hmm. So since then, I have garnered six honorary doctorates. And it turns out that when I left high school in St. Louis, 1938, I think it was, I had to leave in a hurry because I was in a little problem, and I had to get out and go to work because the funds had run out at home, you know, so I had to go out and work. And I didn't get a chance to pick up my high school diploma. So after having received six honorary doctorates, I played in the St. Louis area and received another doctorate, the last one I received in that area. And a representative group came to the concert, and some certain doctor comes up to me and he says, "I'm Dr. So-and-so, I represent the Shad High School, and we discovered that you were a salutatorian of your class, and we noticed that you didn't receive your degree, your diploma. So we decided that we would give you your high school diploma." So I graduated from high school at 74 years old.
All right. That's pretty cool. That's pretty good. That's good. Now, I'm wondering, I'd like you to tell people how you got the nickname Mumbles.
Because I failed the elocution test.
Okay. Elocution test. I know. I've heard why they call you Mumbles.
Yeah, that was an old thing that we used to do back in St. Louis, my hometown. There were several places of refreshment, dens of iniquity, whatever you want to call them, but they were just...
Yeah, I know what they're called.
Yeah, and they always had a piano player with an upright piano, the top of which was triply laminated to withstand the weight of several steins of beer. Uh-huh. And if you bought the piano player a beer, his top of his piano was loaded with beer, so much sunk in the middle. If you bought him a beer, he would play for you to sing, regardless of how horribly you might have sung. He'll play for you, makes the introduction, bling, 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 and you start singing. And what you sung about didn't matter, you know. People in the audience couldn't care less. They were there to have fun. So You start singing, and the tempo was good, and they would start snapping the fingers and patting the hands, as Ellington would say, earlobe tilting, and snapping stomping on the floor, which was covered with sawdust, till the sawdust jumped up 2 or 3 inches off the floor. And the fun and the merriment was the only thing that mattered after the situation was started. You might have decided to sing about the way you wanted your eggs cooked in my... I want my eggs in the morning. But after that, after you want your eggs, who cared how you wanted them?
That's right.
As long as you got them. And that was my put-on of the old blues singers in those days. That's the way they sounded.
That's the way they sounded. Oh, because I heard you do it in a concert, and I said, ah... Oh, I'm trying to think. Well, Clark, I know you brought your horn.
Is this the one that... all right, now.
Here's the one that...
That is the one that got stolen. Oh, my gosh.
Miraculously recovered. I'm so happy. It's just like I see programs on TV where families are separated for years and they finally become reunited and they're just overwhelmed. Well, that's the way I feel about becoming reunited with my long lost one. It was only lost for 2 weeks, but that was too long.
That is too long. Only lost for 2 weeks.
Yeah.
Oh my.
Yeah, it was really unbelievable. And yeah. Some little dude who worked in the hotel absconded one with my horn. They made an appeal to anyone with a $500 offer, no questions asked, for the return of the horn or any information as to where the horn was. Somebody could have said, "I saw a horn laying over there on the floor. Got $500, no questions asked." But this little dude thanks to his ignorance and stupidity, he walked. He rather than to do that, he went to the pawn shop a block away and pawned it for $50.
Figures, doesn't it? Figures, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Oh, okay. Because I just said, well, if you wanted to improvise a little something for us,
well,
do that, and we have a, you know.
I'm not too good at playing without a full breakfast, and I only had 2 cups of coffee.
Oh, dear. Oh, dear. Well, I do know some nice lady brought you some sandwiches over there in the office. Yeah.
Yeah. In that case,
I might be able to play 2 measures.
Okay.
Thank you.
Oh, Clark. Oh, this is wonderful. Well, you know, we've talked quite a while.
We've talked a while.
Yeah.
Seems like we just got started. And I have to apologize again for that cold. I have a little cold. And as I said before, tonight when I sleep on the park bench, I'll make sure nobody opens the gate.
Okay, and make sure they have some extra newspapers out there for you.
Yeah, that creates such a draft when they open those gates, you know? It's horrible.
Well, thank you very much, Clark. I really appreciate this, and it was so nice meeting you. I'm so glad to introduce you to the folks in our area.
Thank you very much. Thank you.
You are in the Jazz Room. I'm your host, Joan Watson-Jones. You just heard an interview we conducted with Clark Terry back in 1996 at the University of New Hampshire. We now have here in the Mobile Jazz Room, Paul Verrett. Mobile Jazz Room, yes, Paul. Professor Emeritus from the University of New Hampshire. Paul has maintained contact with Clark Terry through the years. And, well, welcome, Paul.
Well, it's great to be here again.
And I'm glad we have you back. Now, Paul, you were part of the, in the interview, Clark talked about being honored with the first honorary doctorate in the University of New Hampshire. Now, you were part of that program, weren't you?
Yes, I was.
Can you tell us more about it?
Well, when my colleague, Professor Dave Seiler, came to UNH in 1971 from the University of Idaho, he had started a jazz festival out there, which is now the Lionel Hampton Jazz Festival. And he's this was for high school students and so forth, educational project. He did something similar here, which is still running very successfully. And Clark Terry was the guest artist in the second of those festivals. And as a result of that, he was very helpful to us in a number of ways, including helping the UNH band to go to the Montreux Festival in 1976. And several of us got thinking of the fact that he was a person of stature not only in the jazz world as a performer and as an educator, but he was also a great role model in the African-American community and lived an extremely rich and detailed and eventful life as an African-American in our society. And we also learned that he did not have an honorary doctorate from any place, which he well deserved. So we went ahead and made the recommendation, and it was honored. And so this was the first of Clark's honorary doctorates in 1978. He now has, I believe, 18 honorary doctorates.
Well, that's wonderful. That's truly a feat. And he did talk about that in his interview. How many more came on? Came after that one. Now, what has been the relationship with Clark Terry and the college through the years?
Well, through the years, from time to time, we would invite him back. We didn't want to do anything that would suggest we were trying to exploit the fact that we had given him a doctorate. Then in the 80s, allowed us to use his name with the Jazz Festival, so it's the Clark Terry UNH Jazz Festival. And he was given the title of adjunct professor at UNH. And then in the early 90s, the president, who Dale Nitschke, who was then president of UNH, was very interested in diversity issues and African-American issues. And it struck me that he was a person that Clark should have a conversation with, a private conversation with, and we set that up. And he and Clark have actually become very good friends, and they're still in communication. And President Nitschke made it possible for us to have Clark come here each semester to do a brief residency of 3 or 4 days, in which he deals with the UNH Jazz Band and various classes of music majors and non-majors. And in his younger days, when he had when he was healthier and had more energy, we would take him off campus to high schools and so forth, and try to capitalize on his great capacity to communicate with kids, and the fact that he could answer the same questions from students year in and year out as if it was the first time he was talking to them. He never sounds really bored or annoyed that he's hearing the same stuff over and over again. He just talks to the kids with great warmth and a great sense of wanting to communicate to them the richness of his experience.
We have coming up in a couple of minutes, a workshop that Clark conducted with a number of students. I'll let you hear that in a little bit. But Clark also talked about reaching non-music majors as well. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, every semester we try to get him into what we call a 401 class, Music 401, being a large kind of music appreciation class with usually about 120 students in it. And then the room seats about 135, so we fill it up with other people. And he'll talk to the kids and let them ask him questions about his life and so forth and so on. And some of that is particularly interesting, especially how he managed to break the color line in the studios in New York. But he's very good at getting a room that large full of kids who are not musicians actually doing something musically. He'll get them to be able to perform a 12-bar blues and so forth. And he'll bring some students with him, and he'll have the students, music students, have them play along with him. But he's just very good at generating generating interest and generating insight, and doing it tirelessly and warmly.
Now, can you bring us up to date a little bit? A little bit.
Yeah, Clark's now 88, or he'll be 88 in December. His birthday is December 14th. He has actually celebrated his several of his birthdays here on campus. And you know something about that. His health has been, he's had health problems for a long time, but he's maintained through all of his physical problems. As we say in the business, he's maintained his chops. He still plays very, very well. And so when he comes in the spring to UNH, there's always a concert at the end of the jazz at the end of the festival with some of his chosen guests, and his own playing. Several months ago, he had a heart attack, and he's recovering from that now. I talked to him about 2 or 3 weeks ago on the phone, and he said that he was hoping to go to Europe in the fall to do a gig, and that he would be back with us in the spring. So that's about the best I can say right now.
Well, that's wonderful. That's great. That's great. At least we have an update, and we started out with 1996 with our interview that we did when he came to the college, and that was my first experience with Clark Terry, meeting him there. And well, thank you very much, Paul Verrett, for coming and filling us in. Thank you for coming to the Jazz Room.
My pleasure, especially to be in the Mobile Jazz Room for the first time.
Well, you never know.
Now let's listen in a bit on the improvisation class Clark led for the UNH Jazz Band students.
Make a hula. 3, 4, right.
Another cut from the Clark Terry Quintet CD, Serenade to a Bus Seat. You're listening to Cruisin', and that's what we're doing right now, cruising till the end of the program. We've come to the end of another show. Thank you for spending time here in the Jazz Room. If you wish to see a photo of Clark Terry during his interview in 1996, please visit the Jazz Room page of my website, joanwatsonjones.com. You can also email me your questions and comments from the site. We love hearing from you. You have been in the Jazz Room. I'm your host, Joan Watson Jones.